at Harrah's and Harvey's in Lake Tahoe. This is the a planning meeting for the Neural Information Processing Systems Organization, which will be meeting here after it's done its Granada meeting, becoming here on a permanent basis. And I've been talking to some of the people who are here to discuss the future of NIPS. One of them is Hannah Wallach. Welcome.
Thank you.
Who's at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And in the Department of Computer Science.
That's right. Yes.
So what's your primary interest? Why are you associated with NIPS? How did you get involved with NIPS? What's the story?
Right. So my research is broadly speaking in machine learning, specifically statistical techniques for dealing with large quantities, often of text data. I first went to NIPS in 2002. I've been every year since then. This is going to be my 10th year at NIPS. I really think of it as being sort of my home conference and my home community. Nowadays, my research has sort of broadened out a little bit from core machine learning, and I tend to work on computational social science. So answering questions to do with social science using large-scale computational, mathematical, statistical techniques for analyzing massive quantities of communication and collaboration data.
It's an interesting phrase, that, isn't it? Computational social science.
Absolutely.
Because it sounds like those things are antithetical in the sense. I mean,
in some ways, perhaps that's the case. But really, I think what the phrase really means is we're sort of moving beyond this age of social science being about small observations, small studies, groups of participants who are observed in great detail, all of their interactions mapped out, and moving to a situation where we're looking at really large scale interaction data. So the kinds of data that are produced and generated just in the day-to-day courses of people's interactions, and then using statistical and computational techniques to analyze these data and answer and identify questions about social behavior.
Well, give me an example. I mean, I know about books like The Wisdom of Crowds and so on.
Right. So there's a number of different things. I mean, it's actually a very, very wide-ranging field. One of the areas that I do a lot of work in is working with political scientists.
Just going to interpolate that. I was thinking about a UCSD colleague, James Fowler, mm-hmm. and Nick
right.
Christakis.
Right.
Is their work in the same sort of areas you're talking
absolutely.
About?
And in fact, James came out to UMass Amherst earlier this last academic year to give a talk about some of his work involving Facebook and some of the kinds of research that he's done there. This is absolutely broadly within that space of computational social science. It's a pretty wide-ranging field, and one of the interesting things is because it's a field that's really only started to emerge over the past year or two, it's still being actively defined. There's no single coherent definition yet of what computational social science is, who's involved in it, what it encompasses, and where it's going to go. This is kind of being actively defined as the field is moving forwards.
So do we have anything that you would regard as being substantive research that actually applies to things like Facebook and Twitter and
absolutely. So there are many people who have done research analyzing Facebook data, analyzing Twitter data. A colleague of mine, Mark Dredzi at Johns Hopkins, had some really nice research recently analyzing Twitter data in order to make predictions about things. There's a lot of interest at the moment in looking at these kinds of data in order to draw conclusions about large-scale behaviors of people and about society as a whole. And one of the interesting things about this is that we're using data that people are generating in their everyday lives. This is not the kinds of studies where you closely observe people and you intervene with their interactions. This is actually using interaction data that they're just generating as part of their day-to-day occurrences. And as a result, in some ways, it gives a more unbiased way of looking at these kinds of behaviors.
Do you think so? Because do you not think there's a chance that the sort of entries that people put on Facebook, say, are not necessarily an accurate reflection of their being?
So, absolutely. So firstly, there's always a difference between people's online behavior and people's offline behavior. But one thing that I found really interesting a while ago, and I can't remember now where I read something saying that people's web pages are not accurate reflections of themselves because they're curating these things to cultivate a certain image, to represent themselves in a certain light. In contrast, Facebook, where your friends, people you're connected to, can post on your wall, can write messages to you, you have much less control over that. And so in some ways, Facebook profiles are actually a more realistic reflection of people than things like web pages, where they actually can have that kind of ultimate control over what appears and what doesn't.
So they may actually be more of an accurate stream of consciousness.
I think so, and certainly more so than, for instance, websites and stuff like that. And this is one of the distinctions that I deal with a lot, the difference between formal data, so for instance, publications or patents or people's web pages, things like that, and informal data, data that just sort of arises in the course of everyday interactions, things like perhaps mailing list postings or email or Twitter or Facebook and these kinds of things.
So what would be the ultimate aim of what of your research trajectory at this point? What are you trying to find out?
My primary aim is to build tools that help decision makers make better decisions. And these might be decision makers in terms of people who are working in policy, perhaps science and innovation policy, or people who are working in government and are making political decisions, or even people who are making decisions in their day-to-day lives. And I'm really interested in building tools that analyze and synthesize large quantities of information that are too large for an individual to go through and read by hand, and actually enable them to kind of make decisions and draw connections that they perhaps would otherwise have not been able to do.
So this is a theme that's come up from the other folks I've talked to as well in the last day or so. Making better decisions.
Absolutely.
And doing that by crunching vast amounts of data that we weren't able to crunch before.
And spotting patterns that aren't perhaps visible to the naked eye when people are actually looking at data themselves. Yes, exactly. Basically taking vast quantities of data that do exhibit patterns and structure, but in which these patterns and structure may be obscured in some way, and actually revealing them such that decision makers can use these patterns and structure to better inform their decision-making process.
Right. So how did you get, it obviously, anybody listening will realize that we're both from the same country, obviously.
Absolutely.
why are you here? How did you get here? What's your background?
Right. So I...
Parents?
Yeah. So I originally thought I was going to go to university to do engineering. I didn't know about computers growing up. I just didn't really encounter them and hadn't particularly had any background with them. And for various reasons, as people often do in the UK, I took a year off between high school and university. And during that year, I worked for the materials science department at the University of Cambridge. I worked for an architect's firm and I worked for a local electronics company. And while I was working for these places, one day I got to work and the people who I was working with said, "We'd like you to design a website." And I turned around and I said, "A what? What's that?" And they said, "Well, there's this thing called the internet, and there are these things called websites, and you make them using HTML, and here's a book, go learn about it and make us a website." And so I went away and started reading about all this stuff and learning about the internet. And within a week, I was completely hooked. I thought, this is what I want to do. I'm fascinated by computers. At the time, I was supposed to be going to university, to Cambridge, to study engineering. And everybody I spoke to said, no, it's far too risky to switch to computer science at this point. Everybody else will have a lot of background in this area, and you won't. So I started at university studying engineering. My first lecture was on C++. I thought, this is going to be absolutely fantastic. Unfortunately, the next lecture was on thermodynamics or mechanical engineering or something like that, and it was all kind of downhill from there. By halfway through that year, I asked whether I could switch into computer science, and my college was a little resistant at first.
Where were you at this point?
I was at Cambridge. I was at Newnham College.
At Newnham?
Yes.
Okay, well.
And ultimately, I ended up teaching myself the syllabus from the first year of the computer science degree, and then switching into the second year. and I've never looked back.
Were your parents scientists at all or not?
My father is a material scientist. He's a professor, and my mother is her field is social sciences.
Okay, so there was a science background as well. So.
Absolutely, yes, yeah. Yes.
Now, did you encourage? I mean, you obviously encountered some resistance during all these various self-taught enterprises of yours. Was there a rapprochement at the end? I mean, did people finally say?
Absolutely.
You done good?
Yes, absolutely. after Newnham giving me, you know, many, many hoops to jump through in order to change into computer science and me repeatedly going along and jumping through them all, at the end of my degree, I won the 2001 National Science Engineering and Technology Award for Best Computer Science Student based on my undergraduate project. And when that happened, I got a very nice handwritten note from the principal of the college saying that, you know, I had completely justified my decision to switch into computer science. And
how many women applicants were there for that?
For that, I have absolutely no idea.
But scanty, I would have thought.
Presumably, yes. I mean, computer science is really not a field with a huge number of women.
Or engineering.
Or engineering, for that matter. This is changing. But it's taken really sustained efforts from people in order to actually start to affect that change.
I mentioned to you that often when I have women scientists here, I ask them whether I should retire this, what seems like a tedious old question about, is it harder to be a woman in science and so on. To a woman, not to a man.
Don't
they say
retire
no.
That
don't resound that question.
Yes.
you actually have set up a thing called Women in Machine Learning, WIML.
That's right.
So I assume that the reason for doing that is that you've felt the same way as these women I've been speaking to. That
absolutely. So it all actually came about right at NIPS. I'd been attending NIPS since 2002, and every year I'd gone to NIPS, I'd shared a hotel room with whatever male graduate students in my lab were going that year. And in 2005, I ended up sharing a hotel room with Jennifer Wortman Vaughan, who's now an assistant professor at UCLA, and Lisa Wehner, who's no longer involved in machine learning research. And we thought it was amazing. There were three of us, a whole three women in machine learning. We thought it was fantastic. So we got to talking and we thought, well, there must be more people. Even though we're not seeing people around the conference necessarily, there must be more women in machine learning. So we decided that we wanted to hold some event for women in machine learning. We went away and we wrote a proposal actually for an event to be held at Grace Hopper. In the end, it didn't get held.
Just elaborate on the Grace Hopper thing.
Sure. Grace Hopper is a women in computing conference. It's held every year. There are women from academia, from industry, students, established researchers, all kinds of people. And really the goal there is to promote and encourage women in computer
and
science.
And my memory is that she was in the Navy, she was an admiral.
That's
or
right.
something,
That's
and that
right.
she was associated with the term computer bug.
That's right. I have no idea whether that's actually
true or not.
That's just one of those anecdotes, but yes, exactly.
Yeah. Right.
So we proposed a Women in Machine Learning workshop as a session for Grace Hopper. After several months, Grace Hopper turned around and said that they loved the idea, but they weren't happy about us choosing all of the speakers and participants. So we decided at that point that perhaps we wanted to simply co-locate the event. So we held the first Women in Machine Learning workshop the day before Grace Hopper in 2006. So it was co-located with Grace Hopper, but not actually a Grace Hopper event. And it was a phenomenal success. There are emails between me and Jen and Lisa in which we say things like, oh my goodness, there are 25 women in machine learning. Well, when we actually had that workshop, there were 100 women present, which was just unbelievable to us, going through the three of us sitting in that hotel room, feeling as if there were probably no other women, or possibly other women in machine learning, but just not knowing who they were, where they were, what they were doing, to sitting in that room with 100 women, all of whom were dedicated to working on machine learning. It was pretty fantastic. At that workshop, we asked the participants whether it should become an annual event, and it was pretty much unanimously decided that yes, it should. So the workshop was held again in 2007, again co-located with Grace Hopper. After that year, we decided that this wasn't really the most appropriate conference to be co-locating with, and that there would be much more benefit to co-locating with NIPS. So in 2008, WIML moved to being co-located with NIPS, and it's been co-located with NIPS ever since then.
So that'll be improving the NIPS profile in terms of...
Right. So it's actually done for a number
membership.
Of reasons. One advantage, so we hold the Women in Machine Learning workshop on the day before NIPS, and this is done very specifically. One of the things that we were deciding when we were deciding to co-locate with NIPS was, did we want to have this as part of the regular workshops at the end of the conference, or did we want to have something specifically before the conference? And we decided it was really important to hold the Women in Machine Learning workshop before the conference because of the fact that this would give women the opportunity to get to know each other before the main conference events started to take place. Then, as they're going around, you know, participating in the conference events, they'll see familiar faces, people who they know, who they've already spoken to, and as a result, will find the whole experience far less isolating than perhaps they would have done otherwise.
All right, so go back to your the beginnings now. I mean, you were at Cambridge.
Yes, that's
but
right.
But then you didn't stay at Cambridge, you went to Edinburgh?
That's right. My undergraduate degree was at Cambridge, and then I did 1 year of engineering and then switched into computer science. Then I went to Edinburgh to do my master's, where I was doing a cognitive science master's, although that program sort of got subsumed into this big informatics program that they now have. After that, I went back to Cambridge to do my PhD. And it was during that first year of my PhD that I went to NIPS for the first time. And while I was at NIPS for the first time, I met three researchers whose research I'd done some follow-on work about as my master's thesis. I asked all three of them whether I could come and work with them for 3 months that summer. And the net result of that was that I ended up at the University of Pennsylvania for 3 months at the end of the first year of my PhD. And somehow 3 months turned into 4 years, and I ended up doing a sort of bi-continent PhD where I was living in Philadelphia working at the University of Pennsylvania, but traveling back to Cambridge to meet with my advisor every couple of months. David Mackay. And then at the University of Pennsylvania, I was working with Fernando Pereira, who's actually program chair this year at NIPS.
Right. Nice circle.
Exactly.
Nice circle. Do you have, you give talks.
I do indeed give talks.
Do you, even though you're not entirely an ancient person, What is your advice to your young confreres, your young scientists who are just about to embark on this field?
Wow, I have a lot of advice for people. One of the things that I think is really fundamentally important is getting to know the people in the field and what they're working on. Go to conferences. I've spoken to young researchers many times who've said things like, oh, I don't want to go to a conference because I don't have a paper there this year. I feel uncomfortable talking to people if I'm not presenting my own research. And I think it's important to go anyway. I think it's important to go and to find out what other people are doing, to introduce yourself to people. It's important to become part of that culture to really find out what the field is doing. And sure, you may not have a paper 1 year, but you'll have a paper the next year or perhaps the year after. It's really important to actually get integrated into that research community.
The papers, the whole notion of papers, the whole notion of research, the context, and so on. You've heard me say this before, that when students are starting out, they feel so harried by the need to perform well in tests that they limit themselves by just using the university system to download the PDF of just exactly the papers they need, but don't read the rest of the book of the front of Nature, the front of Science, and so on. So it's done without a context.
Did
you have that
really
sense?
I mean, that's really one of the advantages of going to conferences, is that you see work presented that you perhaps would not have necessarily downloaded the PDF about, and you overhear conversations about work that is perhaps not directly related to your area. And sometimes this kind of stuff doesn't seem relevant at the time, but then many years later you might come back to it and say, hey, what was that paper that I heard a presentation about, you know, at NIPS back in 2004? That's now relevant to what I'm working on now. And I think that's really one of the great things that conferences can offer people, is actually that contextualizing and connections with people outside of one's own immediate research area.
Yeah. How do you see your work translating into the future in terms of practical applications and so on?
Right. This is something I've been thinking about a lot recently, because obviously my home community is the machine learning community. At the end of the day, you know, I am a machine learning researcher. That is what I do. But equally, in order to actually make progress in computational social science, it's really important that I make contributions in other fields as well. So for instance, I just attended a conference on political methodology. We had a paper there on analyzing press releases. And so I think over the next few years, one of the things that's going to happen is that people like me, who are really interested in interdisciplinary work, are going to go to some of these other venues, and simultaneously, as well as doing that and presenting our work and presenting interdisciplinary work at these other venues, we're going to start bringing people from these other conferences back to the NIPS community. That's something I've actually been trying to do for the past couple of years. Last year at NIPS, Jennifer Wortman-Vaughan, who was actually my co-founder for the Women in Machine Learning Workshop, she and I organized a regular NIPS workshop on computational social science and the wisdom of crowds.
Right.
And as part of that, we brought in invited speakers, not just from the NIPS community, people who would ordinarily be attending NIPS, but people from other communities as well who perhaps wouldn't be attending NIPS. So people from economics, people from political science, people from sociology, and actually got them to attend and give talks. And the workshop was a really big success. We had probably about 80 to 100 people there for the entire day, and we proposed a follow-on workshop again this year with an additional co-organizer whose background is actually much more in the social sciences than either myself or Jen. And we just heard that it got accepted, so we're going to be doing the same thing this year, and again bringing in people from the social sciences to start to become integrated within the NIPS community and to find out more about what's going on there.
Right. Could you just, for a general audience, though, explain what this term means? I mean, I'm looking at your paper here, your website, Machine Learning for Computational Social Science. Mm-hmm. Machine learning, one of the greatest, fastest growing areas of computer science, is uniquely positioned to act as a framework for developing methods and tools.
Yes.
What do you mean by machine learning?
What do I mean by machine learning? Well, that's a very good question. And I could give you the answer of perhaps, you know, the area of machine learning that I work on, but there are so many different aspects of machine learning. Broadly speaking, we're talking about mathematical tools for analyzing large quantities of data. And the specific area that I work on generally draws on ideas from statistics, specifically Bayesian statistics, but there are many other people who actually don't do very much work with Bayesian statistics or even statistics in general, but perhaps rely on ideas from algorithms and theory and stuff like that. Machine learning itself is basically a really interdisciplinary field, but the fundamental core component is that of mathematical rigor and of analyzing data at a really large scale in order to make better decisions.
Have you read any of the literature on male-female differences in terms of mathematical reasoning and so on and so forth?
I have.
You know the books by Luanne Brizendine and various other people about gender differences.
Yep.
What's your take on that?
My take on that is, before we start pointing fingers at biological differences that we don't know anything about, we should work out what's going on at a societal level. There are huge societal pressures on both men and women to act and behave in particular ways, and I think it's really, really, really important to actually start looking at some of those things and questioning some of those things before we assume that there are innate differences. And this comes into play at really early ages. So there's some research by actually I can't remember who it's by, but about risk-taking and parents, and the way that parents encourage their male children and female children to engage in risk-taking behavior. And the particular study is set up such that parents are told to allow their very small children, you know, 2 or 3 years old, to wander around in this room. And when they feel that their child is at a distance, that, you know, it's been starting to become unsafe or risky for them to be wandering around, they're told to, you know, call their child back. And the distance at which parents will call back their female children versus their male children is really different. The female children are called back much before the male children are called back. So there are clearly differences in terms of parents and just what parents encourage their children to do, whether their parents encourage their children to take risks, all of this kind of thing. Plus, there's other differences as well. I was involved in a study of free and open source software developers. Because the gender differences there are even more striking. Only 1.5% of free and open source software developers are female. And one of the things that was found there is that the average age that women typically get their first computer is much older than the average age that men typically get their first computer. Women typically get their first computer at around age 19, whereas men will typically get their first computer around age 12. And when I mean first computer, I mean their own computer that they can do whatever they want with, not computer that they're sharing with their parents or siblings. And this is really fundamental because at age 12 or 13, you know, young teenage years, you don't really have much to do. And so you can spend a lot of time playing with the computer and kind of learning things and teaching yourself how to program and stuff like that. Whereas by age 19, you're already at college, you already have responsibilities and things you're supposed to be doing. And so these kinds of differences really do come into play in terms of the routes that people take in their careers.
So extrapolating from all those things we've just talked about, let me ask you the question that you've heard me ask other people about the rightful place of science in society. How do you see its role? I mean, the president talked about restoring science to its rightful place. Well, I mean, what are the coordinates of that?
Wow, that's a big question. I mean, obviously, science is fundamentally important to society, and it's important that we as scientists are able to communicate what we do to society. That's something I think about a lot, because as an academic, I have to give talks, not only to my colleagues within machine learning, but to colleagues within computer science, but not in machine learning, to colleagues in other fields, and even to the general public. And I think it's really, really important that as a scientist, I know how to communicate my own work at various different levels that are appropriate to the people who are actually listening to these talks.
Yeah. When you do that, I mean, when you give talks like that, I mean, what's your sense of the audience response? Not to you, but I mean, in terms of the subject matter and the whole ethos, and do you sense a hunger out there for?
Absolutely. People are fascinated by machine learning and by computational social science and all of these things. I mean, everybody at this point in time, pretty much everybody uses computers. Pretty much everybody deals with large quantities of information, searching for things on the web, reading news stories, all of this kind of stuff. And so everybody uses computers in a way that could benefit from better tools to help them make decisions on the basis of this information. So there's really a lot of interest when I talk to people. And they may not understand the fundamental mathematical underpinnings, but the motivations, the reasons for doing it, and even the end results are of great interest.
So what's your take on this? Let's go back to that question. Let's circle back to that question about whether the internet is dumbing us down.
Right.
What's happening with digital culture? I mean, what are the pros and cons?
Yeah.
I mean,
Well, just on a day-to-day level, I certainly notice that I feel much less burdened to actually remember things. But when I know where I can look them up. You know, I remember where it is that I can look something up, and I know that if something's really important and I really do need to remember it, it'll remember itself. You know, I will end up remembering it just because I will use it sufficiently often that will happen. But, you know, this is very different to something like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, where there was much more emphasis on reading things in books and memorizing things, because there weren't easy search interfaces for simply digging into quantities of information and extracting that one particular nugget that somebody is looking for. So I think from that point of view, the internet is possibly dumbing people down, but it's also endowing them with potential and abilities that they ordinarily would not have had before. They're now able to search through vast quantities of information and find not only what they're looking for, if they're looking for some specific thing, but also things they're not looking for as well, that will enable them to actually draw conclusions and actually make decisions in ways that they perhaps would not have anticipated or would not have done if they'd only been able to read things in physical books.
Do you think much about the sort of history and philosophy of science and so on? Suppose I gave you a time travel token and said that you could bring anybody to your dinner table.
Oh, wow.
From anywhere, any period in time, any discipline.
Yeah.
Is there someone you'd just love to have a conversation with?
Yes, Claude Shannon.
The father of information theory.
Of course. I think it's safe to say that information theory changed my life. I had not been at all interested in probability or statistics or any of this kind of stuff, and I took a course on information theory as an undergraduate. The person teaching that course walked into the room and said, "Forget everything you've ever learned about probability and statistics." And I thought, well, great, that's fantastic, because I don't remember any of it. And they started again from scratch, talking about Bayesian statistics, about Bayes' rule, all of that kind of stuff, and then started talking about information and this notion of probability and information being related. And quite frankly, it blew my mind. I found it to be the most interesting thing I'd ever heard. And that was, I guess, in some ways, what got me started down this entire path. So really, yeah, I guess I'd like to meet Claude Shannon. That's who it would be.
Could you do an idiot's guide to what Bayes? We sit here and I talk to people, and the phrase Bayesian goes swiftly passing by, but there must be people at home who think, what are they talking about?
Absolutely. So there are a couple of things that I really think characterize Bayesian statistics and Bayesian inference. The first is the notion of probabilities as degrees of belief. So not probabilities as something that represent, you know, the number of times that you're going to flip a coin heads versus the number of times that you're going to flip a coin tails. So something where you actually have to perform repeated trials in order to quantify that probability. But probabilities as, you know, what my belief is, for instance, that the moon is made of green cheese. So things, and the advantage being that you can actually quantify probabilities for things that it would not be possible to perform repeated trials for. So that's point number one, probability as degree of belief. The second thing is about reasoning under uncertainty. So actually representing parameter values and stuff like that as uncertain variables in and of themselves, and endowing them with prior probabilities, and then performing inference with respect not to some fixed parameter value that we've learned from some one specific data set, but performing inference with respect to the whole posterior distribution over parameter values. So basically, I see it as a framework for firstly quantifying reasoning under uncertainty. So beliefs, combining that with evidence, and then drawing conclusions and making decisions on the basis of that. And secondly, doing this in a way that is really much more robust to uncertainty, or at least explicit about uncertainty, and representing that uncertainty and keeping it around throughout the entire inference procedure, rather than collapsing things down onto a single value early on and drawing inferences just on the basis of those values.
Did you ever read anything about Thomas Bayes?
Yes.
You know, but he kind of got trumped by Laplace, really, didn't
right,
he?
Yeah,
because
right.
Laplace is
right.
ended up.
Yeah, and one of the things that I
popularizing what we now call Bayesian probability,
sure,
right?
Yeah. Sure. No, and there's a very long history, and there are very, very many people involved who've contributed in many ways. It's obviously not simply Bayes himself. There have been many people over the years, and continue to be many people, who make really, really great contributions to Bayesian statistics.
It's just an interesting story, though. I recommend to people at home that they should go and look that up in Wikipedia or something.
And it's always worth going to visit his grave as well. If one is in the UK.
What?
It's worth visiting his grave if one is in the UK.
Where is it?
It's in Tunbridge Wells, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you been?
I have not been. It's on my list of things to do. Yes.
All right. So that was your time travel token, Claude Shannon.
And
possibly. Let me ask you one final question here. What are you optimistic about?
Everything. I think this is a fantastically interesting area to be involved in. Machine learning is really this fundamental area that affects so many different disciplines, not just, you know, statistics and stuff like that. There are people who are doing work in vision, language, social science, as I've been talking about today. This is really a field that changes multiple different disciplines, and I think it's going to continue to do so over the next you know, few decades, really. I think there's really a lot of potential for people to be able to actually deal with much larger quantities of information, to better reason under uncertainty, to engage in better decision-making processes as a result of the kinds of tools and models and methods that are coming out of machine learning.
But you see that going into weren't you telling me you were doing something with the National Institutes of Health as well?
That's right, yes. Yes. So we've just completed a project with the National Institutes of Health where we've been using machine learning techniques to analyze grant proposals. The idea being that there are 27 institutes and centers that make up the National Institutes of Health, and a program manager who is trying to make decisions about which research to fund or not fund and stuff like that, they really can only know about their particular area of expertise. But of course, there are all these other institutes, all these other program managers, all this other research that's being funded. So it's really important that decision makers at the National Institutes of Health are able to quickly and efficiently find information about related areas in this vast quantity of data. So we just completed a project, or are still working on it in some ways, where we're using machine learning methods to analyze grant proposals in order to identify related grant proposals, in order to identify related funding agencies and stuff like that. The idea being that we can use these techniques to help decision makers within the National Institutes of Health do their jobs better.
Well, so that, I mean, that's, let me just follow up on this for a second here, because it's interesting. If you talk to researchers, playing devil's advocate for a moment here, they're not usually very charitable about the way they think decisions are made at National Institute level. And novelty, for example, is something that's not always supported. If you want to get a grant, you should just do what you did last time with a slightly different twist so that nobody's worried, frightened, and so
on. It depends on the institute.
Unless you're at HHMI. And
right, exactly. I was just about to say, they fund people rather than projects.
Right.
And one of the reasons for doing that is it encourages much more potentially risky and groundbreaking research, because people are no longer worried about having their funding cut if the particular project doesn't succeed. They can simply move on to a different project and start working on that. In contrast, it's true that the National Institutes of Health is much more concerned about deliverables and sort of predefined project objectives and stuff like that. But these are fundamental funding strategies that these different institutions have chosen to make. And one of the things that would be really great is to be able to actually provide concrete data-driven evidence based on publications, based on follow-on research, based on researchers' trajectories of what are the benefits and disadvantages of these different funding strategies. And these are the kinds of questions that I'm really interested in answering over the next few years.
Well, I'll be interested to find out what you find out too.
Fantastic.
Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you too. Thank you.